Are higher rates here to stay? Hi, everyone. Welcome to the Real Vision Daily Briefing. With me today is Bob Elliott, co-founder and CEO, CIO of Unlimited Funds. Hi, Bob. It's great to have you back again.
Hey, Maggie. Great to see you.
So we thought we were going to get a little rebound in stocks today, and they were most of the day, but they kind of faded into the close here, and we ended up with losses, all except the Russell. The Russell looks like they're hanging on. And we had Treasury yields edge lower. It seems like it's going to be one of those weeks where we meander around. We had stronger than expected durable goods, but consumer confidence dipped a little. We know we've got a PCE reading at the end of the week. So it seems like a good place to just start off and kind of take a look at what you see happening in the economy. Since we are getting a little bit of mixed readings, where do you think the U.S. economy is?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's always important to recognize that the economy moves way slower than all of our expectations, and certainly anything that's on Twitter on a day-to-day basis. And so, what we're seeing with the economy has been 7 quarters of above, at or above potential growth. And we're kind of seeing the same thing play out, but we're seeing a little bit of deceleration, I'd say sort of through the quarter here, with some of the later data a little softer than some of the earlier data and the strength that we saw in the second half of last year. So modest deceleration. And I think the real question is what's going on that inflation side of things, which is starting to pick up, showing some signs of at a minimum not moving durably down to the 2% or below 2% threshold. And I think in particular, starting to raise questions with the rebound in oil prices and gasoline prices, starting to raise the question of, is a three handle on inflation kind of where we're going to be at for, through the course of the year.
Yeah. And it energy was a big relief, and it seems like whack-a-mole, right? I mean, I think everyone has anecdotal evidence. In fact, my husband just messaged me. He was in New York City today and just messaged me, inflation, it's real. And it was like the smallest cup of yogurt ever for $7. Like, that's not unusual for New York. But I mean, even that, I was like, wow, okay. Like, you better go hungry. But I mean, it was kind of shocking. But I feel like we all still have instances where sometimes we're like, okay, like I feel a little bit better about this. But a lot of the time we just feel that stickiness of certain things just don't seem to be going down, or there's periodic food, depending on what you're buying, get a break on eggs, something else jumps up. It doesn't feel like we're having this really rapid deceleration. So I mean, it still may happen though, right? Inflation lags, doesn't it?
Yeah, well, I think the complicated thing with inflation is that there's a bunch of different moving pieces that are sometimes moving counter to each other. So, the initial bout of disinflation coming from the fact that gas prices went from 5 to 3, which then flows into all sorts of different places in the economy. And then also a big shift downward in durable goods as the supply chain issues started to get resolved, started to see a drop in used auto prices in particular, but also imported durable goods. And so that created like a big disinflationary impulse on the economy and brought inflation down considerably. I think the key question, and at the same time, the services side of things, you can look at a lot of different pieces of it, but it's certainly not moving rapidly down. It certainly remains relatively elevated. And I think the challenge is, as we look ahead, some of those big disinflationary impulses that existed with, oil prices and gas prices falling and having another leg down through the end of the year, but now reversing and, up 60, 70 cents, depending on exactly what you look at, and having those durable goods prices that were falling now starting to rise. I thought it was one of the more interesting pieces of the inflation report was durable goods disinflation started to flip to inflation. That's not a good sign at a time when those sort of the services side of things just isn't moving down as fast as certainly the Fed would hope. That's not a great combination on a forward-looking basis. And so I think that's when Chairman Powell talks about needing more evidence, that's what he means. It's not like no one's sitting here thinking, oh, inflation is going to go to 5% or 10% anytime soon. The question is, are we stabilizing at 3, or are we stabilizing at 2 in a compelling way? And I think that's the question that he's got on his mind. And I think there's good evidence to suggest that maybe they shouldn't be confident that it is there, particularly on a forward-looking basis.
Yeah. How do wages plug into this? Because, you know, there was a time back in the day, I always remember that being the scariest thing for the Fed, because wage inflation is really something that never, or I shouldn't say never, but is typically hard to reverse, right? You don't, once you get that wage, it's very hard to get to take it away without inflicting a lot of pain or layoffs and kind of resetting the whole situation. They get baked in for years at a time. Are we seeing that, or is the labor market's been tricky, right? Because we don't know what's temporary or business cycle. We don't know what's structural. It seems like it's been kind of hard to figure that out. What are you thinking about in terms of wages?
Yeah, I mean, wages are critical. If you just think about, like, at a very simple level, inflation in the economy can be seen as how much are people earning relative to what their productivity is. And the difference between those two things essentially has to be prices, because, you know, what they earn, they spend, and what they produce gets bought. You know, it's a little more complicated than that in reality, but that kind of gives you a good benchmark of how to think about wages. And so nominal wages continue to be, you know, moderately elevated. They've come down a little bit, but still, particularly when you look at the wages of high propensity to spend income cohorts, so say you're 60th percentile and below, or you're 80th percentile and below, those wages continue to grow pretty rapidly on a nominal basis, a couple, let's say 2% above where they were pre-COVID. The interesting question, the key question, is how much productivity are you getting out of those workers? We have seen a pickup in productivity and measured productivity over the course of the last couple of quarters, back to sort of the longer term trend line. If that continues, then, you know, we could live with 5% wage growth and 3% productivity. That's an okay outcome. I think the real question is that really durable over time? And do we get that nominal wage growth derailed by input costs like gasoline prices going up, you know, 20-25%? That's a big deal. You know, if you're in the lower income cohorts with the high propensity to spend, that shift in gas prices from the low threes to the high threes matters for you in the day-to-day basis.
Yeah, it does. We used to always think about it as an immediate tax, right? I mean, it's something that hits a pocketbook instantaneously. You really feel it. It's got a really, like, sort of gut visceral response, because you got to open up your wallet every, you know, hour, depending on how often you drive, and Americans drive a lot. So against that backdrop, does the Fed's plan to cut rates 3 times seem doable against this backdrop?
Well, I think it's a good question. And certainly, when you look at that situation, certainly from the market pricing, a lot of the easy money has been made. We came into the year, it was 6 or 7 cuts. The economy was growing above potential, and there were inflationary pressures that had yet to be resolved. And the idea that the Fed was going to cut 6 to 7 times was not reasonable. Despite the, you know, the real rater type comments that were going on, we've adjusted significantly now to 2 to 3 cuts priced into the market. You know, from my perspective, I look at that and I say, is that what I do? Probably not. On the margin, will the Fed probably do less than that, given the data, you know, the data that's likely to come out? Probably. But when you're talking about, you know, the difference between, are they going to cut once or twice? You know, you're kind of like splitting hairs there at that point, certainly from a trading markets perspective.
Yeah.
In a way that I don't, you know, it's within the cone of plausible. It's also very plausible that zero happen over the course of the year. But you know, we're in the ballpark of not too much easing is likely to occur given the momentum that exists both in inflation and in the economy.
Yeah. Which is, as you say, very different from where we came into the year, what we came in thinking. So Jack Burnett gets the gold star today, because I think he's asking the question, certainly, that we're all thinking about and that you've been tweeting about. If the long-term rate is closer to 3.5 to 4% instead of 2%, first of all, let's start with, is that a likely scenario that we need to adjust to? And then I'll ask part two of his question.
Hey, everyone, we're going to take a quick break right now to hear a word from our partners. We'll be right back with more of the day's top analysis on the Real Vision Daily Briefing.
You've heard the headlines. Inflation is unchecked. The dollar is collapsing. The government is printing too much money. Well, the fear may be real, but there is a solution. Gold. Gold isn't collapsing, and gold's value increases during inflationary times. Noble Gold Investments is here to help you protect your wealth. Noble Gold Investments is the gold IRA company that Americans trust. The founders of Noble Gold have more than 20 years of combined experience in buying gold and silver. They have secured more than $1 billion in precious metals for their clients. Whether you're a seasoned investor or new to the game, Noble Gold Investments simplifies and secures your gold investment journey. You see, unlike money, the government can't just print more gold. It's your shield in times of economic uncertainty. And gold remains steady when inflation is on the rise and the dollar is in turmoil. So, invest in something you can hold. Go to noblegoldinvestments.com/vision to get started. Don't wait. That's noblegoldinvestments.com/vision.
Few investments make a better long-term hedge against inflation, depression, and economic downturns than precious metals like gold and silver. Plan for the inevitable and protect your environment savings with a gold-backed IRA from Noble Gold Investments. Noble Gold Investments is the gold IRA company that Americans trust. The founders of Noble Gold have more than 20 years of combined experience in buying gold and silver. They have secured more than $1 billion in precious metals for their clients. Gold remains steady when inflation is on the rise and the dollar is in turmoil. Its value doesn't just hold, it increases during inflationary periods. And unlike money, gold can't be printed. It's your shield in times of economic uncertainty. Invest in something you can hold. Go to noblegoldinvestments.com/vision to get started. Don't wait. That's noblegoldinvestments.com/vision.
Yeah, I think it's a critical question to start to be wrestling with. I remember in this cycle when the short rate was at 2.5%. And Chairman Powell said it was highly, you know, it was restricted at 2.5%. And you looked at it and you're like, I don't think so, man. That,
yeah, yeah.
You know, and he tried, you know, he was trying to back away at that. And, you know, even at rates at 5.5, you know, and in the high fours and through to the mid fives over the course of, you know, basically, a year plus, growth has continued to be at or a bit above potential. And so you sort of look at that picture and you say, you know, the overall sensitivity of the economy to the short rate, to the existing long rate structure, you know, even with interest rates in the, you know, between 4 and 4.5%, things are okay in the economy. And so what that highlights, I'd say on a tactical cyclical basis, that really raises a question of whether, you know, there's enough tightening that exists on the short end to really slow things down meaningfully or quickly. I think the question on the longer term, which is what does that longer term neutral interest rate look like? I think part of it is, first of all, a lot of uncertainty. And, you know, there'll be seven academics in a room and you get seven opinions about it and seven highly quantitative models describing what's going on. So, you know, we have to accept the ambiguity of it. But I would say, look, there's a lot of people who talked about a 2 or 2.5% rate back during the post-GFC era where we had huge debt overhangs and in the private sector and depressed spending and incomes. That sort of story is not really pertinent to today. A lot of the healing has happened in the private sector in terms of the balance sheets. Mm-hmm. If anything, we're moving to an era where we're starting to get likely a lot more investment, part of it supported by the government and part of it, you know, private sector driven to as a part of the deglobalization dynamic. So that's a draw for credit. And at the same time, the global savings glut has really stopped in a way that it had existed right after the GFC, where you had global central banks basically recycling liquidity into U.S. treasuries and into U.S. dollars. You know, places like China are more concerned with their currency going down than going up these days. And so you basically have this situation where probably the demand for capital on a forward-looking basis is meaningfully higher than where it was back in the post-GFC period. The supply of capital is probably lower. And we've got this, you know, this inflation issue, which we at least have to acknowledge is more of an issue today than it was, you know, 10 years ago when people were more concerned about deflation. You put that all together and probably the sort of baseline level of interest rates that you're seeing is probably going to be higher, certainly than 2.5, which is where we were for the last 15 years.
Which is why this is a big deal. Like when I saw that tweet, I was like, when we're changing from basically assumptions that we've held for 15 years, That sounds like a big deal. So the other part of Jack's question, I split it into two, but his question is, are there areas of the market that will adjust higher? That's such a great neutral way to put it, Jack, because I'm wondering when I hear that, okay, is the fact that the neutral rate may be closer to between 4, maybe 4.5, 5% even, is that in and of itself a bad thing? And then I think his question is, what is that adjustment? If there are areas that have to adjust, what does that look like?
Well, it's a bad, I mean, it's a bad thing if you're a bondholder,
right,
and you've locked in low interest rates for an extended period of time. Those people who came to the year buying in the, you know, at 375, if the neutral rate is, you know, closer to 4 to 5, and on top of it, you have a circumstance where the term premium is pretty depressed right now as well. You could, you know, that's not a good picture for bondholders. And I would emphasize, like, this assumption that the Fed is going to bring interest rates back to 2.5 or 3% in this cycle is baked in all of these different models. Like, you know, I'm sure you every once in a while bump into a few interviews on Bloomberg, and you listen to the bond people, and basically every single bond person says, well, you know, the long-term rate is 2.5, or yeah, the Fed will bring interest rates down to 3. Like, imagine those folks, and that's causing them to buy. To be clear, that's right, causing them to buy yield at, you know, 4.25. At 4.25, if your long-term rate is 2.5, it actually looks like a pretty good deal over a cycle time frame. When those folks start to say, I'm not so sure, right? Maybe I need to pencil in a higher number. And we're actually seeing that in terms of surveys of professional economists and dealers. Mm-hmm. We're starting to see that long-term rate expectation creep up. When that shifts, that totally changes the valuation picture on bonds. And so, you know, bonds, particularly risk-free bonds, treasury bonds, serve as the backbone of the whole economy. If every, you know, we already saw last summer, it doesn't take that big a rise to start to upend the apple cart and create some risk to stocks due to the rising discount rate if those yields rise. So that's, you know, a lot of the rest of the financial system is really dependent upon this continued expectation that interest rates are going to be low for a long time.
Yeah. So the argument when you hear that is that even if the Fed will go back to that rate, even if they have to inflict pain to get there, but you're suggesting maybe they don't go back to that.
Right. Well, I think that's part of the question is if the economy is structurally running hotter with higher productivity, higher demand for capital, lower savings rates, et cetera, you can have an economy that continues and higher inflation. You can have an economy that continues to be fine, right? You can have your unemployment rate at, mm-hmm, let's say 5, which, you know, to be clear, the average unemployment rate is 5, not 3, not 3.5, not 4, it's 5. The idea that you could have an unemployment rate, just in terms of thinking through things, let's say we had, you know, long end yields move to 5 and we had an unemployment rate of 5. That seems like a perfectly plausible solution to the macro economy. And that could, you know, and would that be, that would be undesirable tactically for the Fed, but in a strategic sense, you know, a 5% unemployment rate would be fine, would be a fine outcome.
Yeah, this is
why
I asked, is it in itself a bad thing? It sounds like it's just settling where the economy can handle it, right? And as opposed to everyone hating zero interest rates and some of the repercussions that come from that and being worried about deflation, you're in a different regime. The problem and the rub is that the system is built on expectations of it being at 2 or 2.5%.
Right, those expectations, you know, I always like to joke, the fact that the bonds are in the stocks, right? But the bonds are also in the credit, and the bonds are in the loans, and the bonds are, you know, bonds are in everything. The bonds are in the houses, you know, that's kind of the challenge from an asset holder's perspective is the fact that we're moving to a structurally higher rate may not be so bad for the real economy, but it isn't great for asset holders. Now, the question is, does that yield move so fast that it then creates enough of a hit to asset prices to then flow through to the real economy as spending slows and creates that sort of downward dynamic? You know, we saw just a taste of that last summer, although, you know, even with rates at 5, you know, like, look, big picture, like stocks were down 10%, 10, 15%, you know, stocks go down 10 or 15% over the course of 3 or 6 months. It's like not that big a deal. And the economy actually accelerated. It didn't actually deteriorate. Now there are other things going on. I wouldn't necessarily draw that linkage to it. But the idea of saying, like, could the real economy tolerate, you know, an environment of moving back to 5% interest rates, given all the things that are going on? Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely could.
The asset, the financial economy cannot, though.
Well, the financial economy, you know, has high sensitivity to that sort of dynamic. And obviously it depends, because it depends on essentially the duration sensitivity. You know, there's a lot of assets that are out there that are not that duration sensitive, but, you know, there are certainly many assets that are duration sensitive. And what would have, you know, I think the question that you sort of have to pencil through is, what would, you know, stock, if interest rates go to 5% from where they are today, you know, that's 75, let's say a 75 basis point rise at, I don't know, 15 years of duration, you know, that would get you, you know, again, another 10 to 15% hit in stocks. Is that enough to derail the recovery, or is that just simply annoying for equity holders, you know, that we're hoping for, you know, YOLO NASDAQ to go through the roof and never stop going down, right? Like my guess is it's more of that latter, which is that you can have the real economy persist kind of okay, you know, persist okay, and have a moderate hit to asset prices as the interest rates reset. It's really a question of, does that then beget more concern about interest rates? Does that create bond vigilantes? Does that start to spook investors who so far are, you know, when the yield rises, they come in and buy? Just look at the flows into the TLT. Like, it is, you know, typically the way it works is, for stocks, when stock prices go up, people buy, and when stock prices go down, they sell. For TLT, as that yield rose, people were pouring into TLT, buying the yield, buying the yield, buying the yield, as long as that persists.
In the anticipation that it would drop later.
In the anticipation that it would drop, or just like they were looking at it and they said a 5% yield is not a bad yield, all things considered. And so as long as that dynamic persists, then probably the yields don't rise too much. Certainly they don't rise to whatever that crazy thing that was said back in October, like yields are going to rise to 17% or something. That, you know, that's probably not going to happen. The real question is, do they rise to 5 in this sort of environment as things reset, or do they rise closer to 6? And the difference between stocks getting, you know, a drag of 10 to 15% versus, you know, 20 to 30%, that's a big difference in terms of what the second order consequences are in the real economy.
Yeah. It's a fascinating problem to work through, because it doesn't seem like anyone's positioned for that.
We're going to take another quick break to hear a word from our partners. We'll be right back with more of the day's top analysis on the Real Vision Daily Briefing.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
You've heard the headlines. Inflation is unchecked. The dollar is collapsing. The government is printing too much money. The fear is real, but there is a solution: gold. The government can't print more gold. Gold isn't collapsing, and gold's value increases during inflationary times. Noble Gold Investments is here to help you protect your wealth. Noble Gold Investments is the gold IRA company that Americans trust. The founders of Noble Gold have more than 20 years of combined experience in buying gold and silver. They've secured more than $1 billion in precious metals for their clients. Whether you're a seasoned investor or new to the game, Noble Gold Investments simplifies and secures your gold investment journey. Choose between a tax-advantaged gold IRA or have physical gold delivered to your door. Noble Gold Investments ensures a seamless and easy transaction. Invest in something you can hold. Go to noblegoldinvestments.com/vision to get started. Don't wait. That's noblegoldinvestments.com/vision.
Not many people are positioned for shift to meaningfully higher rates. And I mean, it makes sense why that is, which is that, you know, in general, asset managers are invested. They're investors and they are invested. Mm-hmm. And so in a lot of ways, it's functionally hard for many asset managers to be positioned for that. And what really matters is what the marginal buying pressure is. And I mean, we know that obviously there's a lot of marginal buying and selling pressure. And from that perspective, I think we know that there's obviously a lot of treasury supply here as we step into quarter two. The net supply of duration is going to be about twice what it was in the first quarter. And that's up from, you know, last summer, where essentially, you know, it was very, very, very low given the various TGA, you know, the debt ceiling and the TGA refill, et cetera. Right. And so I think that's a really interesting question. We're gonna get a good sense of the sensitivities, because it's gonna basically ask the question, it's gonna give us a good insight into how much do yields need to rise, or do they need to rise in order to swallow that duration supply at the current price levels. My guess is we probably will need to see higher interest rates to get those rate sensitive buyers to come into the market. I should say they're rate sensitive and yield curve sensitive. So if you're, as a simple example, like Japanese buyers are typically buying, in a currency hedged way. You know, that currency hedged way is essentially a bet on the yield curve. What about households? You know, they're buying TLT. How high do yields need to go in order for them to look good about it? We sort of achieved balance at 5%, which I wrote at the time, actually. At the time, I was like, yeah, 5%. I sort of add up all the buyers and it kind of looks, you know, close to in balance. It looks reasonable. The question is, as we go to this next round, where maybe the disinflationary forces aren't quite so present, there's some concern on the upside, and where we've extended growth and the level of equity prices, are people going to need something higher than 5 to come in and swallow that higher total duration supply?
Yeah, which, gosh, could make for a real summer of discontent. So to follow on and stick with Jack's excellent question for a moment, two areas that seem like, because he's sort of saying basically where's the pain, right? Where the market adjusts higher when you're talking about treasury yields. What about commercial real estate? This sounds like this would be the last thing that the commercial real estate market would need.
Yeah, I mean, commercial real estate, I think the challenge with commercial real estate is that it's not all that viable at 4% yields or 5% yields or 6% yields. And so I think...
So maybe it doesn't matter as much, so because
the question is sort of the marginal impact. I think probably there is not all that big. It matters whether the yields are 4 versus 6, but you know, the big problem is that no one's going to the office, as evidenced by...
But like,
you know,
the idea of extending and pretending, if you get those rates down, you know, if they were going to go back down to 2%, yes, you still have a problem. You still have the distressed guys that have to come in, and you have a liquidation that could probably take, like, savings and loans, someone refers to it, you know, decades to unwind or repurpose. But now the idea that you're in a different rate regime can only make that, you know, I think that situation more difficult.
Yeah, that's right. I think the main thing with the CRE world is that it is almost entirely on balance sheet loans.
Yeah.
And the one thing that the banking system is really, really good at is extending, pretending, modifying, you know, terming
restructuring.
Out, restructuring, like that whole world. Like, if there's one thing bankers are good at, it's not necessarily making loans, but they're darn good at dealing with bad loans.
And they have a lot of experience.
They have a lot of experience dealing with that. And I think there's a lot of regulatory relief that exists for them to, you know, not necessarily resolve those things immediately. I put out something a couple of weeks ago, you know, since CRE like blew up, let's say everyone started to talk about it like early last year, you know, the banking system has earned about $60 billion in NIM from CRE and they've lost $600 million. So that gives you a sense as, you know, $60 billion of NIM, $600 million of losses, charge-offs that have occurred. I give you a sense, like, this is like watching paint dry. It is not, you know, people who relate this to the financial crisis, not at all the financial crisis.
That was the wheels coming off the entire global system. This is a problem that they know how, it's painful and painstaking, but they have done this before in many different areas.
Exactly. And banks can... The whole cleverness of a bank is that they earn the income today and they take the losses over an extremely long period of time. And that allows them, if the losses are big enough, to out-earn through their NIM on other assets, on other loans, which to be clear are resetting. We have to remember that. Mm-hmm. Like, those things are resetting. NIMs are actually fine. You know, they're staying in the 2.5-3% range, you know, 3.5 for some of the smaller cohorts. Those are decent NIMs. They can absorb a lot of losses with NIMs like that for an extended period of time. And so it doesn't mean that, like, you know, our bank's going to be making money hand over fist? Probably not. Are the ones that are concentrating these assets going to, you know, are their stocks going to be fantastic? Probably not a great stock pick. Depends on what's priced in. But, you know, you could easily see the stocks kind of being, you know, bad performers for an extended period of time. But that's very different from this is the thing that's going to bring down the economy.
That's a great observation, because we get a lot of questions of people worried about commercial real estate. And I think that that's a really, really sort of accurate description of banking. NIM is net interest margin, everyone, by the way, the amount of money a bank makes on earning on its interest in loans. This is another great question, because I know you're looking at Europe, you're looking at Japan. Two different people are asking it in two different versions, both Mark and Ralph. Any chance other central banks go before or instead of the Fed? And importantly, does it matter? Another great question.
Yeah. Well, it matters. You know, the beautiful thing about trading markets is you can bet on the other markets, and the money doesn't care whether you're betting on the ECB or the Fed. So that's always something to keep in mind when you're thinking about how do you build diversification. You know, when I look at, I think probably the place that looks most interesting to me is what's going on with the ECB, you know, who has talked very hawkish, but under the hood, what you see is there's a pretty big difference in terms of the inflationary picture in the US and in Europe. And I think it was overshadowed by the Fed situation last week. The ECB, the quarterly wage numbers came out about 3.1, down considerably from where they've been running 5-6%. And if you watch the Lagarde press conferences, which, you know, I recommend at triple speed, if you're gonna waste your time with that,
every Fed speed, conference, the way every to go. Central banker.
That's right. Exactly. Speed that stuff up. It was kind of the primary sticking point. If you go back to the last couple of meetings where they were like, we're not so sure, wages are a bit of a concern, we want to see them come down. And in order for us to feel comfortable, we need to see them come down. 3% is a bit higher than what it was, you know, prior to COVID, but it's not, 3% is fine. They can deal with 3% wage growth in the economy. And that's going to, you know, combined with the fact that we're likely to, you know, get soft enough readings on inflation, that my guess is the ECB is going to be faster moving than what we see with the Fed in terms of, you know, responding to the real economy dynamics. The growth is also a little softer there.
Yeah.
And things like, you know, other elements like that, that are not literally in their mandate, but certainly influence what they're thinking.
So I always like to end it with you, Bob, about where you see opportunity right now. Sounds like it's not U.S. Treasuries.
it's so not U.S. Treasuries. Yeah. That's for sure.
What do you like here?
Or maybe I should say that is an opportunity, right? Well, you don't have to be long only,
that's right?
You know, I think when I look at the market, a lot, you know, we came into the year and basically people were underpricing the durability of the economy and the need to not cut nearly as much. And so positions like long stocks versus bonds and, you know, short rates both look pretty attractive coming into the year. Most of the money in those trades have been made, I think, at this point. You know, like, look, on the margin, do I think the probabilities are probably a little too high of cuts, you know, in the summer months, given what we're seeing in the data. So, you know, maybe that's a fade a little bit. I think the real question is, what is it, you know, what's going on with the long end? And are we going to have an environment here where there starts to get pressure in the long end? That's a place, you know, maybe a yield curve steepener, I think is an interesting bet from a risk reward perspective. You also get a little bit of tail risk protection in the event of a one-off, you know, unexpected shock into the market. So I like steepeners in this environment. The dollar is also pretty compelling in this environment. from the perspective of the U.S. economy continuing to run hot, but and other central banks being a little more dovish than what many people are expecting. And so the dollar across several developed crosses looks compelling, as well as particularly places like the UK and Europe are likely to shift to easing given their economic circumstance. And honestly, the BOJ is likely to stay easy. You know, the real question is, like, when is the BOJ going to run tight monetary policy? The break even right now is the day I retire. You know, I don't know.
And since we know you have new additions, that's a long way off for all.
And that's a long way off.
Exactly. Bob, great stuff. It's not something people are talking about. We've all kind of just listened to that press conference from Powell and thought, oh, they're dovish, and everyone's just chugging along on that assumption. But I heard someone the other day have the greatest line, which is that it doesn't matter what part of the market you watch, everyone has to be a rate strategist because it matters so much.
That's right.
So to get a perspective on that, super important for our audience. So thank you so much.
Yeah, thanks for having me. It's always great to catch up.
Great stuff. And congrats again on the little one.
Thank you.
Thrilled for you. Hopefully you get a lot of sleep. Hopefully he's a sleeper. You're laughing. I know the early days are rough, but wonderful.
Right.
All right. Thanks, Bob. We'll see you again soon. Thanks to all of you. We'll be back same time tomorrow. Take care and good luck out there, everybody.
We hope you enjoyed this episode. At Real Vision, we arm you with the expert knowledge, time-efficient tools, and a powerful network to help you succeed on your financial journey. Get a taste of financial freedom with our free offer at realvision.com/free.
The first taste of rare bourbon you finally got your hands on. That's nice. At Caskers.com, we make this experience easy. Caskers is a one-stop spirit curator with an impressive selection of exclusive, sought-after, rare, and household names in the realm of premium spirits and champagne. Discover the top flavors of the year now by going to Caskers.com and using code WELCOME10 for $10 off your first purchase. Get $10 off your first purchase with code WELCOME10 at Caskers.com.